I'm Liz Wall.
And I'm Jessica Aro.
Today we start with the atrocities in the Ukrainian town of Bucha. Civilians and journalists recount stories of war crimes, systematic execution-style killing of civilians with their hands tied behind their backs, rape, torture, and mass graves. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is calling it a genocide. Russia has responded with denials and lies, the Russian Foreign Ministry calling the atrocities, quote, staged, and claiming the bodies were, quote, fake dead bodies.
To discuss Russia's war crimes and its information warfare in Ukraine, we have Jakub Kolensky. Welcome. He's a former journalist and now expert on Russian information and hybrid warfare. He was previously with the European Union East Stratcom Task Force and is currently at the Helsinki-based Hybrid COE, an international organization that works to combat hybrid threats. Welcome and thank you so much, Jakub, for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me. Thank you for the invitation.
Of course, it's an honor to have you here. Which would you say at the moment are the most dangerous conspiracy theories that the Kremlin is spreading? And what kind of information warfare is the Kremlin waging against Ukraine at the moment?
Yeah, I think you actually answered your first question. I think the most dangerous lies, the most dangerous conspiracy theories the Kremlin is currently spreading are those concerning Ukraine. The Russians themselves seem to believe it. The Russian soldiers believe it. And they go and they murder people because of the lies spread by the Kremlin. From the intercepted phone calls between the soldiers and their mothers, we see that the audience in Russia believes these lies. And unfortunately, these lies can also affect the public opinion and the decision-making in the West, the way we will react to the war in Ukraine. And that, again, can cost lives. It's a couple of days ago, there was this opinion poll published in Slovakia, according to which one third of the population actually believes that the war in Ukraine was caused by the West against all the facts available. So we see that Russian propaganda managed to persuade one third of a whole population. How many people do we have in Europe who are believing these lies? So I think the disinformation campaign targeting Ukraine, that will be the most dangerous one because it unfortunately really costs many lives.
Yeah, Jakub, I want to ask you, because there was this chilling propaganda article this week from the Russian news outlet RIA Novosti. It calls for de-Ukrainization of Ukraine, mass killings, destroying its culture and its identity. Do you think that this propaganda article conveys Russia's true intentions? It echoes back to the times of Stalin. How does this article and similar disinformation operations aim to conceal Russian war crimes in Bucha and beyond?
Unfortunately, if we have a look at the real actions of the Russian army, I believe we can say that the propaganda article conveys Russia's intentions. And I think we need to go back a few months or even perhaps a few years. The articles claiming that Ukraine is not a real country and Ukrainians are not real people, which is a messaging that in effect justifies killing Ukrainians, that's something that even Putin himself, or probably his ghostwriter, was writing in the article on the historical unity of Russians and Ukrainians, which was published by the Kremlin last July. And the messaging that Ukrainians are dangerous Nazis, which in Russian vocabulary means that they need to be exterminated, that's messaging that we all could see on Russian state TV throughout the years following 2014. The campaign has only the bigger effect the more it's spread. And since it's been spread for the last 8 years continuously, it definitely has a huge effect on the Russian audience. The fact that they are spreading these lies right now has probably at least two more tactical reasons. First, the Kremlin needs to justify why are Russian soldiers dying? Why is Russia leading a war that results in total international isolation? And yet another aggravating of the already bad situation of ordinary Russian people. And for that, they need to have this grand enemy who poses a massive existential threat to Russians. And secondly, the Kremlin needs to justify the horrible, barbaric crimes they are committing in Ukraine. If they manage to persuade their people that they stand against an inhumane enemy, these crimes are suddenly more easily explained.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Russian disinformation, they repeat this false notion of Ukraine not being a country. And it seems like their war is, they're making it so by physically annihilating and killing, the mass killing of civilians. It's like they're making it a self-fulfilling prophecy. One remarkable difference in today's war in Ukraine, covering this for 8 years in comparison to the first invasion 8 years ago, is the political climate in the West, specifically in the United States, and attitudes towards Russia. For example, some of the most watched hosts on Fox News echo Russian propaganda, hinting to that similar theme of Ukraine not really being a country. How does that factor into Russia's information war against the West?
I mean, what you mentioned, it just sounds incredible to me. And it just shows that the effect of Russian information is there and is undeniable. If we have domestic actors parroting Kremlin's lines to take, I can guarantee you that those in the Kremlin and in the Russian secret services and the Russian pseudo-media, all these people who are responsible for the disinformation campaigns, they perceive it as their success, and rightly so. But on the other hand, maybe just to provide a slightly more optimistic perspective, I have to say that here in Europe, it really feels a bit more optimistic than after 2014. I have a feeling that in 2014 and in the following years, there were more politicians, more opinion makers, more influencers who were parroting Kremlin's lies about, you know, little green men, that it is not sure if it's really a Russian army invading Crimea, etc. Now we actually see even politicians who spent many years praising everything Putin does, including his crimes. And now we see these people abandoning Putin. So I would hope that at the moment that the mood in Europe is hopefully somewhere else than it used to be before February. On the other hand, this can change. And unfortunately, the Kremlin has a strategy with the European information space, unlike us in the democratic world. They know what they want to achieve. They have the experience. They have the determination. So I think this might change. But I would hope that in Europe, it's a slightly more optimistic image.
Jakub, as you mentioned, I would say alarmingly many in the West, unfortunately, believe in the Kremlin's conspiracy theories and disinformation. What would you say, based on your massive experience and expertise, what should the Western governments specifically do to help those citizens who have fallen as victims of Kremlin's information warfare? And also, what should the governments do to help that they themselves would not fall as victims?
Yeah. Well, I like to talk about four different lines of defense against this kind of information aggression. The first line, and it will sound very primitive, is documenting what is happening in the information space, documenting the disinformation cases. And although it sounds like very easy, we are still not doing it enough. Even in 2022, we still don't know how many disinformation channels Russia controls, how many messages per day they spread, how many people they target, how many people they manage to persuade. The Slovakian opinion poll I mentioned, we don't have these data for, say, all 27 European member states. We don't have this data for whole Europe or for the whole Euro-Atlantic space. We don't conduct these opinion polls regularly, so we don't actually see whether Russian disinformation campaign manages to increase their audience or whether it decreases. So there is still a lot of information that we don't have, and there needs to be a lot more done in this first line of defense, documenting. The second line of defense is raising awareness. So whereas in the first line we are trying to gather more information about what is happening, in the second line we are trying to spread the information. And here, both the government, but also the civil society, the media, the private companies, they can all do be doing much, much more. We have to understand something that the Russians understand very well. Every actor has only very limited audience. You will never manage to reach 100% of the audience. That's why we need various actors reaching out to their various target audiences. And the messaging I can be using with you, or I can be using when we are training governments, or when we are briefing the media, it won't be the language that will be persuading, let's say, pensioners on Bulgarian countryside. So we need various actors who will be helping to raise awareness. And that's why I'm so grateful that, for example, you two guys are doing the work you are doing, because you will have different audiences than I usually talk to. That's why it's important that journalists or even comedians are covering Russian propaganda, making fun of it, mocking it, like the Lithuanian journalist Andrius Tapinas, who does it in his shows, very similar to John Oliver, again, reaching a completely different audience than the governments. The third line of defense would be repairing the weaknesses in the information system that the information aggressors are exploiting. That might be the low level of media literacy in some of the countries. That might be the social media environment, which is obviously a big thing, especially in the English language space. But it might be different weaknesses in different societies. It might be also the socioeconomic differences that the propagandists so frequently abuse, the racial question in the US, the immigration in some Central European countries, the LGBT question in some Eastern European countries. So trying to repair these weaknesses will decrease the target for the information aggressors. But finally, we also need to be punishing them. We have to impose costs on those who are spreading disinformation, because if we don't do that, they will just keep adapting to our defense, and they will continue with their aggression. And we can be doing it by many, many measures, just simply naming and shaming them, calling them out. It wasn't really being done enough. Sanctioning of those individuals who are spreading disinformation, something that, for example, the US and the EU significantly stepped up since February. But I still think that it was done a bit too late. And maybe if we had done it earlier, the problem wouldn't be as big as it is today. But also sanctioning the organizations that are spreading disinformation, be it Russia Today or Sputnik, but also the Russian state media, which are the basis of this enormous disinformation ecosystem. If we sanction them, we would cut them off money from advertisement revenue. If we have a look at the biggest advertisers on Russian state TV, there are many Western companies in the top 15. This might have changed again since February, but it's a decision of the companies. It's not like a systematic solution. So there is still a chance that this will go back to business as usual. And using the already existing laws that we have. In many countries, we have laws against incitement to war, incitement to hatred, incitement to violence, spreading false alarm stories, spreading libels. We have the laws that are punishing many of the activities that the information aggressors are involved in. So these would be the four lines I recommend to both governments and the civil society, what can be done against this.
It can be quite frustrating sometimes as we cover Russian disinformation. I know the three of us have been following this closely for nearly a decade, at least since Russia's first invasion in 2014. But even now, it can be quite frustrating for those, some journalists even, that don't quite understand the real problem that Russian propaganda poses. Some say it's silly because it's not easy. It's so ridiculous that people don't really believe it. But Jakob, earlier you said that there are people that are, you know, their opinions, their beliefs, their attitudes are impacted by Russian disinformation. Can I ask you about that, the scale of Russian propaganda? Because sometimes it's not always just RT and Sputnik. It can come from surprising or confusing places, different types of influencers and commentators, and that tracking Russian propaganda and disinformation in our digital world can be hard to measure. And yet, I think for us studying it, it's pretty clear that there is a very significant impact on our discourse and our democracies.
Yeah, I think you touched upon a very, very important point. And yes, I've seen also many, many researchers or journalists finding the Russian propaganda so amusing and funny that they think it can't have an impact. And I usually tell them that, yeah, if you find it ridiculous, you are probably not the target audience. I think that anyone with even a remote knowledge of Russian disinformation can deny that it has. Quite a big effect. The Russian soldiers who were coming to Donbass in 2014, they were quoting the story about the crucified boy as a reason they come there to kill Ukrainians. To remind the listeners, it was a completely fabricated story by one of the Russian state TV channels, quickly debunked by Ukrainian researchers. Still, the Russian media continued to claim this false story that Ukrainian soldiers allegedly crucified a baby. And the Russian soldiers who were coming back to Ukraine said they were acting upon this story. Today, on the intercepted phone calls between the Russian soldiers and their family members, they talk about denazification with their mothers. I mean, they frequently parrot and quote the talking points of official Russian propaganda. You can see that it has an effect on them. But again, we can have a look outside of Russia. If one third of Slovaks believe that the West is to blame for the war, this is a massive success of Russian propaganda. Take how many people believed and acted upon the lies spread by the pro-Kremlin disinformation ecosystem about COVID. Or take the shooter from the Pizzagate incident, the disinformation campaign around MH17, when even Donald Trump repeated before the 2016 elections, saying to his enormous audience that we will never know the truth, who shot the plane down, because there are too many versions. No, there was only one factual version, and then there were many versions spread by Russian propaganda. So the examples of the effect of Russian disinformation are countless. If we were to describe the whole ecosystem that is spreading the disinformation campaigns, we have to start with the man on the top. It's Vladimir Putin, it's the whole Kremlin, it's the whole government, and we have to include all the embassies everywhere in the world. I invite everyone to check the Twitter accounts of Russian embassies. It's some of the most aggressive trolling that you will see. This has nothing to do with diplomacy. These people are involved in disinformation campaigns for the Russian Federation. Then it's the so-called media, targeting Russian audiences within Russia, the media targeting Russian audiences outside of Russia, and the media targeting non-Russian audiences. The heads of these pseudo-media, like Margarita Simonyan or Dmitry Kiselyov, they openly talk about this as an information weapon of the Russian Federation. Dmitry Kiselyov was describing the job of a journalist as a cheaper alternative to killing people. They make it very obvious that they are involved in information war. And it doesn't end there. Then we have all the NGOs, or maybe we should call them gongos, those government-organized NGOs, those Russian think tanks and researchers who are basically just involved in spreading Russian propaganda. And only later, this will get amplified by the trolls on social media. And apart from this ecosystem that the Russians can control, you will have on the periphery some parts that they might not fully control, but they still help them spreading the same disinformation campaign. The group of people for which there is not the flattering, but still frequently used term, useful idiots who are helping Russia to spread their disinformation campaign. And they have to be counted as part of it, although Russia doesn't control them as directly as they control, for example, Dmitry Kiselyov or Margarita Simonyan. So the ecosystem spreading disinformation for the Kremlin, we are talking about thousands of people, hundreds of millions, or maybe billions of dollars.
So what I have been thinking, what has been disturbing me a lot, is that we are seeing the Ukrainians, their president and many journalists and citizens, asking for help from the West and from the diplomatic community. They're asking for example, closing the skies and more military help, and they're not getting it. So I'm thinking, is it possible that it's the Kremlin's information warfare that is scaring off, for example, Western countries' governments from, for example, intervening in the atrocities and genocide that Putin is committing in Ukraine. Is it really possible that they have scared us not to intervene? Because Putin did threaten us ever since he started his accelerated war in the end of February. What do you think, Jakub?
Yeah. Ben Nimmo has this brilliant 4Ds approach to describe Russian disinformation operations. I believe it's dismiss, distort, distract, and the fourth D is dismay. So if the first three Ds don't work, then you go to this dismaying, threatening, blackmailing. If you do something against my intentions, then there will be horrible consequences like nuclear bombs. I believe it is part of Russian information strategy, apart from the lying, also trying to scare us that if we counteract Russian actions in Ukraine, there will be terrible consequences for us. There will be World War III, nuclear war, etc. On the other hand, I don't think that they would be like 100% responsible for this kind of decision making. I believe there is definitely some part of legitimate fear, which is in place given the track record of Vladimir Putin. It's like in those cases when Russian propaganda doesn't really invent a problem, but they are taking a problem that already is there and they are just making it worse. Like the racial question in the US or the immigration question in many European countries. In these cases, it's really hard to distinguish what is the effect of the problem that was already there before Russians started making it worse, and what is the effect of this Russian aggravating of the problem. So I'm not capable of distinguishing it. If there's anybody out there who knows how to do that, I will be happy if they let me know.
Then one more thing from me, I would like to ask, is there something a regular citizen could do to help Ukrainians cope under fire and targeted by Kremlin's information warfare? If yes, what would you recommend?
I hope there is. I hope that it will help if you go and call out the lies whenever you see them. There are still many people in the democratic world who are spreading Kremlin's propaganda. Thank God, I hope there is less of them than after 2014 and the annexation of Crimea, but they are still there. Call out these Russian lies, call out those who are spreading these lies, name them and shame them. Follow those who are collecting and debunking Russian disinformation, like the EU versus Disinfo project, like the Digital Forensic Research Lab, like the brilliant Ukrainian projects like StopFake, Detektor Media, Text, the Ukraine Crisis Media Center, Ukraine World. You had the interview with InformLab Napalm last time, and many other Ukrainian initiatives. Follow them, get familiar with the lies of the Kremlin, get familiar with the facts on the ground. Arm yourselves for the information war, because if you are not fighting it, there is quite a good chance that you will end up as a victim. But probably most of all, Ukrainians need our help also in the physical space, not just in the information space. And there are many ways how to support Ukrainians directly. So it's also necessary to keep helping Ukrainians on the political level with the sanctions against Russia, with weapons, etc., not just in the information space.
Yes, Jakub, I agree. It's very important for journalists knowing that there is an information war. Russia has an information war in Ukraine, but it's also more broadly in the West. So I think it's important for all journalists to be careful with not amplifying Russian lies, you know, not saying it's like, this is the Russian point of view, calling it lies, calling it disinformation, because that's Absolutely. What it is, because they're conducting an information war. And part of that information war is lies and distortions. I wanted to zoom out a little bit, because I understand you track Russian malign information operations all over the world, from Russia connections to Hungary's Orban, to France's Le Pen. So I think if we zoom out, the greater story is this battle between democracies and autocracies, and it's playing out in this information space. Is that a fair characterization? What are your thoughts on that?
I think I would agree with that. I think I would. You know, those are those who are in favor of a strongman on the top. They frequently say that autocracies are more efficient than democracies. And, you know, they are actually right. If you don't care about the goals, if you don't care about the fact that autocracies are trying to aim for abhorrent and repugnant results, then yes, they are more efficient in achieving these goals. And why? Because they are not scared of the fight. It seems to me that the democratic world got too used to the post-Cold War world where democracy and freedom is easy. I believe it was Edward Lucas who, during one of the conferences where I was present, was saying that we might need to renew this Cold War mindset to understand who is our ally and who is our enemy. So we got used to this idea that freedom is for free, but it is not. And rule of law will not protect itself. There are enemies of freedom and democracy, and we have to defend them against these enemies. And sometimes it does require use of power, although we are not used to it anymore. And I actually think, and I hope that this might be maybe the most important lesson that the Ukrainians will teach the world in the current war. They are showing us what it means to fight for freedom, to fight for democracy. The revolution of dignity in 2013 started because Ukrainians wanted to go the way towards the EU, and the Kremlin didn't want to allow that. Ukrainians are the only people in Europe who were willing to die for the EU. And since then, Ukrainians are defending their freedom of choice. Not even the EU anymore, just their freedom of choice. No matter how horrible and barbaric crimes they face, they are proving that freedom is the most important value for them. It's like in that Ukrainian anthem, which has those beautiful words, the dushu I tilo my polozhim za nashu svobodu, that we will sacrifice our body and our soul for our freedom. And they are proving that every single day. I still think that this is the most important story of the 21st century, and I hope that people in the West are ready to learn from Ukrainians.
Absolutely. Ukrainians are teaching the world about how fragile democracy is and how it's not guaranteed, and we all need to work together to protect our institutions. Thank you so much, Jakub, for your insights and your work in tracking information warfare and hybrid threats. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, and good luck with your work. You're both brilliant. Thanks a lot for that.
Help us fight the information war by subscribing, leaving a review, sharing with a friend, and on social media, and tagging us at Liz Wall and at Jessica Aro.